Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the ESI Bytes Show. My name's Carl Shinneman. I'm Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov. And the goal here at ESI Bytes is to provide information on electronic discovery issues from speakers who give national presentations, write books, things like that, at a price that everyone can afford, which is free, at a place where you can always be, which is in front of your computer or on your iPod, and when you want to listen to it. Today, I'm really looking forward to this show. We've got a great show on legal holds, and our speaker today is John Jablonski, who's a partner at Goldberg Sagala. He's concentrates his practice on commercial and business litigation, construction litigation, product liability litigation, and railroad litigation. In the area of electronic discovery, John consults with clients and attorneys at his firm on e-discovery and legal holds. He's currently the chairman of USA Law Network's Electronic Discovery Practice Group. USA Law Network is a national organization composed of 59 independent member firms in 43 states with over 3,500 lawyers. John's also chairman of the NARTC, which stands for the, what is that again? That's the
National Association of Railroad Trial Counsel.
Yeah, that should always have a description after it.
That's right.
It's NARTC.
Right.
Anyway, he's the chairman of NARTC's National E-Discovery Committee. He's a frequent presenter and author on electronic discovery, electronic evidence, investigations, preservations, best practices for, in particular, corporate legal hold guidelines and implementation of legal holds. He has a blog on legal holds, which is at www.legalhold.com.
Holds with an S,
holds with an S, typepad.com. And he's just written a book, 7 Steps for Developing and Implementing Legal Holds for ESI and Other Documents, which is coming out, being published by ARMA. Glad to have you on the show.
I'm glad to be here. It's a very timely topic, and it's one that I'm constantly questioned about wherever I go.
Great. Okay. Well, first of all, I always like to ask our guests, how did you first get interested in electronic discovery?
Well, it's actually an interesting story because I'm, despite my tender years, depending on the way you look at it, I was fortunate enough to grow up in a school system that had Apple IIe's in grade school and in high school. So, you know, I recall doing binary code to get a stick figure to walk across the screen and things like that. And then technology always was interesting to me and always came easy to me, fiddling around with computers, swapping out hard drives and things like that. And then when I started working for a large law firm, Nixon Peabody, it was early enough that lawyers were actually concerned over whether or not sending email over the internet would destroy the privilege even over a secure connection between an attorney and client. And, you know, looking back at 12 years ago, writing papers on that topic and delving into the world of e-discovery before we knew it was really e-discovery, you know, it's funny to me that if the ethics opinions and the legal opinions went the other way, imagine how ESI would look today if we didn't have lawyers sending privileged documents over the internet to their clients. Privilege review would look a lot different if everything had to be in writing or encrypted in, you know, with bold letters that, you know, this is privileged. It went through 3 case vault security procedures. You had to go to a link to download it. You know, like data privacy is coming along. We probably wouldn't have e-discovery, really.
Our economy would be in the Stone Age a lot quicker than it's gotten to now.
Right. So, you know, so it's funny because now here we are, fast forward, and it's email. Lawyers couldn't live without their BlackBerries. Lawyers couldn't live without email. So the notion that just 10 years ago people were concerned over whether or not they should even send email is just funny. And it actually shows at how fast technology moves and how fast e-discovery moves, and which brings us, you know, to our kind of to our topic today of legal holds. And, you know, since the amendment to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure in 2006, you know, what has been the focus here as far as e-discovery?
Yeah, you know what? On one of my past podcasts, on preservation. The speaker, David Reese, said he was really looking forward to hearing your podcast on legal holds because it is such a hot topic. And why do you think it's such a hot topic?
Well, you know, I look at it as kind of two reasons, really. And the first reason, right now, it's truly at the forefront of e-discovery. You know, the battles that we've had over e-discovery since Zuba Lake, sometimes they revolve around the failure to collect or produce things properly, the kind of actual destruction in the process, the lawyers doing things wrong, a la Qualcomm in the context of trying to search for ESI and producing it to the other side, battles over the form of ESI. But when it comes down to the headline-grabbing spoliation decisions that we get every once in a while, the battle really is really over the legal hold in the case, and then any subsequent destruction of ESI following a implementation of a legal hold that's not followed, or the failure to implement a legal hold. So people are battling over when the trigger event, when a legal hold was necessary. And, you know, as listeners of this podcast know, for spoliation sanctions, the party has to prove that there was a duty to preserve, that there was destruction, and that there was relevancy. And if the party can show that there was a willful violation of a legal hold, or that a legal hold wasn't implemented properly, and can whip that into willful, or, you know, gross negligence bordering on willful, in some jurisdictions, relevancy is out the window. So, you know, if you have a case and you can show that there was a duty to preserve, which equates into a legal hold, and that there was destruction, meaning an automated system deleted email or other programs automatically despite the duty to preserve, then you're done. You've proven your sanctions, and you're going to get perhaps an adverse inference charge to really whack it to your opponent. Secondly, as the vendor community moves the ball forward, you know, the destruction of ESI and collection and production is a rare occurrence. And as companies get more savvy with legal holds, I think most companies would know that they have a duty to implement a legal hold. I kind of look at it as, you know, we get the Web 1.0, 2.0 nomenclature. If we call legal holds 1.0 kind of the Zuba Lake alarm, which was companies wake up, you have a duty to preserve records, which you've always had, and you should show the court that you're doing that by implementing a legal hold, and it should be written, and it should be tested, and it should be updated, and people should be reminded. You know, that was kind of just getting the hold out the door. I call that legal hold 1.0. Legal 2.0 is kind of what we're seeing right now, which is discovery about the discovery. There's been a number of recent cases where the courts have examined the effectiveness of a defendant's legal hold, including 30B6 depositions of legal hold. So if you thought that you were protected as a corporation and you put together a legal hold business process as part of your legal planning, now the second phase is you have to make sure all parts of your organization are trained in it, make sure that it's being followed, auditing the process, refining the process, because it's going to be tested. And you know, we can talk about that as we go on today.
So basically, if you mess up your headline story, the National Law Journal or LTN, or you get blogged by Ralph Losey.
No, that's exactly right, and that's what companies, you know, fear. So there's a whole small industry that's starting to develop around the legal hold process. There's a number of vendors that provide electronic, automated legal holds. But, you know, as I advocate in my book, along with my co-author John Azaza, there has to be some human element into the process for recognizing trigger events. You know, there's no kind of analytical formula that you could put to a computer and load the data and it spits out the date that you were supposed to start preserving records. So if you miss the trigger event date, and there's some recent decisions talking about trigger events, then you're failing to preserve records. So court's looking at it. You failed to implement a legal hold because you didn't know you had to, frankly, but the court deemed you should have known. You're behind the eight ball from the get-go.
Well, let's sort of break it down a little bit. What is a legal hold?
Well, legal hold technically is an affirmative act by an organization to prevent the destruction of documents. This would include physical documents such as paper, as well as electronically stored information, you know, as we've been talking about at CSI, relevant to a lawsuit or a government investigation. Goes by all sorts of names. You'll see in the cases it's called a legal hold, a record hold, a document hold, disposition hold. Frequently it's reported as a litigation hold in response to a lawsuit, regulatory hold, et cetera. But whatever you call it, it's basically implementing your affirmative duty to preserve records within an organization. And that should be distinguished slightly from a legal hold notice. A legal hold is someone at a corporation, perhaps in the legal department, says, hey, we have a duty to preserve records and we need to start preserving records. And then they issue a legal hold notice to the people most likely to be custodians of those records.
Okay. Now, this is sort of where everyone gets real freaked out about legal holds. When is a legal hold required? You know, what triggers a legal hold?
Well, you know, a trigger event is an event that triggers an organization's duty to preserve documents and electronically stored information. Sometimes the trigger event is really easy to see. It could be a catastrophic occurrence. It could be a letter from opposing counsel with the magic words, we will sue you. And actually, there's a number of cases that analyze whether the letter from opposing counsel was sufficient to trigger the duty to preserve records. And basically, it's judged on a new or should have known standard. Did you, as a company, have enough facts in front of you to lead you to believe or reasonably anticipate, is another term that's used in the cases, reasonably anticipate a government investigation or litigation? And it's a fact-intensive analysis many times, if not all the time. And while courts aren't supposed to look at it in hindsight, it's often clouded by hindsight. And I also counsel clients, you know, think of it in this way. You're going in front of a court, and you're asking them to set a particular date as the trigger date. The optimal date would be the date that the lawsuit's filed. Hey, this was blind. We didn't know this was coming, so we didn't preserve anything until we got the lawsuit in the door. And then the other party will obviously try to push that date to the earliest time possible so that they can show that your automated systems were automatically deleting data and other documents that may have been related to the case, so that they want to set the trigger event as early as possible. And trigger event analysis basically requires that corporations train their people in the field to have effective communication and report the sorts of things that they see in the field that would cause them to believe that the company is at risk for a lawsuit or for an investigation. It's really hard for me as an attorney to go into court and to argue that my client didn't have a duty to preserve records when my opponent has a stack of emails that say, holy smokes, we're going to get sued over this. There's a whole litany of common trigger events actually in the book. We have an appendices that discusses all the trigger event cases. Certain types of trigger events can be putting, you know, things that corporations maybe wouldn't realize are a trigger event. You know, the obvious ones are the threat to sue letter, but maybe on the plaintiff side, you're thinking of enforcing a patent, so you sit down and there's a memo in your file that says, here's the list of potential opponents that we're going to sue. Maybe you put your insurance carrier on notice that a certain set of circumstances leads you to believe that you're going to be sued. If people are talking and sending memos around that say, you know, this is going to result in a lawsuit. The other trigger events would be actually hiring experts to analyze the case. When people start writing to each other internally, attorney-client privilege and copying the lawyers on, it's probably a good indication that somewhere in there is a trigger event. So a company needs to analyze all of the facts and circumstances surrounding a situation and then make a determination as to whether or not they believe that's a trigger event. And I always counsel companies that they should try and document that. You know, maybe they don't think that the event really rises to the level that they need to start preserving records. If they could get an opinion letter from a lawyer, or if they can somehow document it in a memorandum, maybe cite to a case as to why they don't think it rises to the level of a trigger event, maybe they have, you know, they should have a stronger argument, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, as in the Adams v. Dell case, 5+ years from now, that circumstance didn't rise to the level of trigger event.
Yeah, that Adams v. Dell case, I guess we can talk briefly about that because it just came out on March 30th out of Utah. In this case, there were two Taiwanese companies, ASUS, it was a patent infringing case, and they were sanctioned for spoliation because they did not implement a litigation hold and start preserving email in 1999. And what makes this case really boggling, and I'm paraphrasing Ralph Losey's blog on this, is that the plaintiff did not even determine that it might have a claim against ASUS until 2005. They didn't send a demand letter until 2006, and they didn't sue ASUS until 2007. So, there have to be some facts here, right, that got the court really upset at the defendant, wouldn't you think?
Well, it's interesting because in our book we talk about industry litigation as being a trigger for a duty to preserve records, and there are other cases that cite to this fact. While it seems particularly egregious that long before a plaintiff even determined that they may have a claim against them, that the court determined that they should be preserving records and other evidence related to this case, it fits in with a trigger event analysis. Although we can only speculate, there could be facts in this case that caused the judge to, you know, not like one of the parties, not like some of the attorneys involved, and really kind of go on a tangent, it appears, to really find the earliest possible time that a trigger event could have existed, especially since plaintiff's counsel wasn't really advocating that a trigger event was needed as early as 1999, which this is just a clear example of what we're talking about. If there were memos in the file of the company that said other members of our industry are being sued over this this issue, we're concerned if they put their insurance carrier on notice of potential claims, if they did some other things that we just talked about, that would create a record that they knew or should have known that they were going to be sued, then I can justify the reasoning behind the case a little bit more. But I still, I agree with Ralph that it's certainly an anomaly and makes it difficult for folks like Ralph and myself to counsel clients on when a trigger event arises versus you might as well just save everything.
Is there any sort of, defendants have been pushing back any e-discovery, not oftentimes successfully, arguing for proportionality to response to the size of the matter, costs the defendant's going to entail, or challenges of accomplishing tasks associated with working with ESI, and there are other factors I'm not recalling, but are there any proportionality considerations when it comes to a trigger and preservation, or you got to start doing it?
Right. Well, the pushback following the amendment to the FRCP in 2006. There are a number of organizations right now which have just started trying to put together information to advocate some changes to the rules. Apparently, the Federal Rules Committee is looking at maybe a wholesale restructuring of the rules. So there are a number of organizational papers that are available that talk about the difficulty for companies to determine both the trigger event and then what should they be preserving in response to their duty to preserve records, and that there has to be some sort of balance and there has to be some sort of proportionality. Rule 1 comes to mind under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. Rule 1 requires the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. So there are a few cases that try to interject Rule 1. There's commentators and some judges, Judge Facciola is one of them, that talk about how Rule 1 extends logically to situations prior to litigation and anticipation of litigation, because the duty to preserve is for the purpose of just and speedy litigation that would flow from it, and not prejudicing one litigant over another. So you have those circumstances. Rule 37E talks about the Safe Harbor Amendment to the FRCP. Talks about in so many words what's reasonable under the circumstances. Kind of I read into it between the lines, because it says that a company shouldn't be sanctioned if it's operating its ESI systems in good faith and not destroying records. But it also requires a company to turn those systems off in the event of a legal hold. So what that means, what sort of destruction is going to take place, what sort of business interruption is going to take place, to me, are all good arguments to make as to trying to introduce some proportionality under the circumstances, being able to try and limit your scope as best you can. Federal Rules of Evidence Rule 401 talks about relevant evidence, and that's evidence that has any tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the termination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence. So my clients are constantly asking me, well, what does that mean? Like, what is relevant? What do we have to preserve for this case? And I explain as best I can that, you know, relevant evidence is basically based on what has happened in the past in similar cases, who has touched the matter, and if you have a data map, are you able to limit the scope of where documents would be stored on your computer system and come up with a credible argument as to why certain parts of your system were left off limits? So those would be ways to introduce that sort of proportionality. The Sedona Conference also has commentary on legal holds from 2007 that talks about trying to interject some proportionality. As I said, there's a number of commentators that are working on that as well. And I just tell folks that to the extent that you have a legal hold problem that seems to be really causing you a lot of expense, try to narrow the scope as much as you can. And if the other side's active in the case, try to use your Rule 26F conference to try and narrow the scope of what you're preserving and try to quickly as possible release certain parts of your legal hold.
You know, I guess the one tip you didn't mention there, it seems in a factual dispute where you need an advocate, you got to have a good lawyer in this area, huh?
I guess I'm humble. it's maybe a little bit off topic, but a legal hold with a narrow scope is probably the easiest way to help companies save money. If you have a factually defensible scope of hold, where you have your IT department or your IT expert will be able to testify as to what certain parts of your system are technically off limits, what your backup systems are like, and you have that integrated with a business process that's repeatable to implement a legal hold, and you're crossing all your I's dotting all your I's and crossing all your T's, then you're going to be starting with a smaller volume of preserved ESI in the first place, which then will reduce your ongoing preservation costs, your collection costs, your review costs, and hopefully have that roll through the whole system. You know, less in means less out, and it really can be a huge cost savings. And then obviously, if you avoid sanctions, that's the biggest cost savings right there.
Now, I'm not sure I heard a lot of great tips and advice there on how to protect yourself if you've covered everything you wanted to add in that area.
Well, I think, you know, the takeaway tips for a number, for corporations or companies or any organization for that matter is really that you have to develop a business process for implementing legal holds, and you have to empower that business process by having someone taking ownership of it and then having someone applying quality control, refinement of the process to make sure that it's actually accomplishing what it's supposed to be doing, that people are getting their legal hold notices in a timely manner, that folks are in the organization are being trained. I think training is one of those areas that is really easy to do. I look at it much like any other compliance training, whether it be in the HR, discrimination, other sorts of compliance training that corporations are very good at. They do on an annual basis. They require people to sign off on it. And if you were able to put together a one-hour presentation that people can look at online, then all parts of the organization would know what a legal hold is, what a notice is when they get it, if they feel that something may be a trigger event, to report it to an appropriate party, an oversight committee with an 800 number or something to allow people to report potential violations. From an attorney standpoint, these would all be great advertisements for building the credibility of the organization and showing that the organization really cares about preserving documents. And even better, when witnesses are being deposed, the trend in these cases are that for whatever reason, a deponent does not know the company's record retention schedule. They may say, yeah, it exists, but we don't follow it, which is often contrary to upper management's testimony that there is a record retention schedule and it's religiously adhered to. And then more importantly, having folks be able to testify in the, you know, from the trenches that they received a legal hold on notice on such and such a date, that they abided by it, that someone called them to follow up. You know, to me, that's a best practice. So we can take the legal hold witch hunt kind of off the table. And if all of your witnesses are testifying to those short facts, then you're a long way to preventing sanctions and other e-discovery abuse. As we talked about, another tip would be using...
I just want to interject there because I've done a number of presentations on records management. And it would seem to me that litigation holds just really reveal the frailty of records management. It lifts the rock up from the ground and shows what a challenge a lot of companies have managing their records without litigation,
well,
let alone telling people what they think they're doing.
Well, it's funny. I just finished working on an article for ARMA's magazine in June and July, and you know, one of the things that I wrote in there was that records management and particularly the legal holds, although I didn't focus on legal holds in the article, is it's a no harm, no foul situation. You know, if the legal hold isn't implemented properly and the case settles and it never comes to light, then there's no problem with the legal hold process. Right? You know,
yeah.
Disaster averted. But once company has to sweat out a couple legal hold issues or ESI destruction issues, which, you know, believe me, in-house counsel, outside counsel, the companies themselves are trying to avoid under all costs, and you're trying to chart a course where they're not going to be sanctioned. So that if you avert disaster, is a really an incentive to go back to the drawing board and make sure that the process is being improved. If a records manager is effective and people are actually following the schedule, it's, once again, no harm, no foul. There's been no disasters at the company. So maybe what's been going on for 10 years is perfectly acceptable. You know, we send out a legal hold notice, IT collects a couple documents, and we call it a day. But as I said with my web 1.0, you know, legal hold 1.0, legal hold 2.0 analogy, the opponents are testing the effectiveness of your legal hold, so you have to make sure that people are trained. And I also advocate auditing by as part of annual reviews. If you just add a checkbox that says In your audit, are you aware of the company's legal hold policy? Are you subject to any legal holds? Are you preserving things in response to the legal hold notices that you received? And make it a performance criteria, you're really sending the message that people shouldn't be deleting these emails as they come in. And when someone from legal calls them, whether it be in-house or outside counsel, that they pick up the phone, respond to the questionnaire, and get their legal hold compliance up to snuff, and it can be checked off on that box. So a real cheap and inexpensive way for companies to really bolster their defensible process is training and auditing.
Okay. Data mapping. That's a big trend now in e-discovery, and data map is a useful tool for legal holds. I did a podcast with Lee Weber earlier on top 10 tips for in-house people, and he talked about the challenges of a data map as a static document and trying to make it more fluid. But so let's talk a little bit about data mapping and your thoughts on data mapping for legal holds.
Sure, I think data mapping is a trend right now. I think it was advocated a lot after the FRCP amendments in 2006 as a way for companies to prepare for the meet and confer and argue limits on preservation and discovery based on the kind of physical structure of the computer systems that are at play at say to litigants. And as with any sort of software you buy, a data map is only as useful as you make of it. So if you have a data map and you spend the money to do one, which I would advocate is the best way to save a company money in the long run, by allowing you to appropriately preserve relevant records that are actually related to a case and not over-preserve. I think the biggest problem in e-discovery at many organizations is over-preserving to avoid sanctions, but then being hit with maybe $1 million bill to analyze all the data that was preserved and not really approaching the legal hold in a strategic standpoint, trying to narrow the scope. So if you have a data map and you have as part of your data map, and I'm just assuming that people know what a data map is, but real quick, basically an identification of all of the storage systems with an organization with contact information, application use, discussions of the life cycle of the creation, storage, and destruction of ESI, in servers, backup systems, legacy systems, et cetera. So if you take that data map and you use the contact information that's developed through that process so you know who your contacts are for implementing a legal hold of the various forms of data, you can then do a scope analysis where, say, you have an HR claim, a discrimination claim. You can say, well, all the HR records are on this one server, and they're only backed up in this one location, and there are 10 key custodians, supervisors, and coworkers with respect to this particular problem, and their emails are only on this other server over here, and they're actually deleted on 60 days pursuant to policy, but they're on a nearline archive for a year, and it's only been 9 months since this potential trigger event happened, and now we're getting a lawsuit, so we definitely know we have a duty to preserve. So I can look at these areas, and if this is a worldwide company, I can argue in my scope analysis that I don't have to go to 98% of the rest of the computer system to try and implement a legal hold and preserve records. So that way I've just eliminated what maybe would have been before, a hold on a whole department's email for the appropriate period of time, pulling of a number of backup tapes if we know that the information related to the case was on an airline archiving system. So we could maybe put down in our scope analysis that, that all active data has been preserved, no need to preserve the backup tapes for this particular case. So by doing a scope analysis, we've saved our hypothetical organization a lot of money in what's being preserved And then as the case progresses on what will have to be analyzed and rolled out in discovery to the other side. So that would be, you know, the most effective way of using a data map. And then I think you mentioned about trying to keep them current. And I think it's an endeavor that has to take place, whether it be monthly, quarterly. Hopefully an organization can task some of the key components of their systems within the data map to keeping it updated. Hopefully the IT segment of the organization finds having that information at its fingertips, if it did not already have that information at its fingertips, a useful tool for them, and that, you know, you could have a live document, so to speak, that's loaded on a system someplace with people being designated updating. Maybe 30 people are updating 30 different portions of it, so that you have that as a live tool. I'm aware of just one evergreen product right now from Xtero that will basically crawl your data system and produce a kind of a dashboard, if you will, of the active system and update it continually.
That's useful. As I'd mentioned, Lee Weber did one of his 10 tips was on data mapping, and I'd refer people to that podcast from sort of an IT in-house perspective on ways to make it more less static and more fluid. And I think he focused on operating systems and things like that. The second point that you mentioned, I want to mention Sherry Harris's podcast on e-scoping, because I think scoping is always makes sense both at the preservation as well as at the review stage. To try to focus your case on, just like we used to do with paper litigation. Anyway, this has been great. I appreciate your adding all these tips and going into this really hot topic here. Do you have any advice sort of at the end here of where people can learn more about legal holds and trigger events? I know we mentioned Sedona and I guess your book.
Right.
Your blog.
Well, no, I appreciate that. And if someone's been interested enough to stay along with us and listen to the end, you know, I appreciate that. The impetus for the reasoning behind the book was when I was starting to counsel clients on legal hold issues about 4 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot of information beyond Sedona, and Sedona and the commentary on legal holds wasn't released until 2007, that really helped companies with the analysis of trigger events, helped companies with how to implement the legal hold. At that time, kind of the state of the legal landscape was you need to implement a legal hold, and then various vendors had white papers, and there wasn't a lot of information, and beyond Zuba Lake, there wasn't a lot of guidance on what would go into a legal hold process. So I had developed for one of my clients a step-by-step kind of flowchart implementing legal holds at their organization, and other companies found it useful. And then talking to John Azaza, who is very active in ARM International, a very well-known records manager consultant, it was having the same issues. So we decided that it would really be helpful for companies to have kind of a how-to book with a flowchart. And the steps in the process will be color-coded and tabbed according to the flowchart, so that anyone in the organization can really pick up this book and access the information that they need to access quickly to develop and implement a defensible legal hold process. And then I've been compiling information more or less that we've collected in creation of the book and keeping updated cases and articles, webinars, anything that you can think of that's focused on legal holds at my blog, www.legalholds.typepad.com. You can go on there and take a look. You can follow me on Twitter from there. My tweets, if we could say that on the
sure.
air, are focused on legal hold issues only. I don't tweet about lunch or anything like that. It's just legal hold. So if you follow me, you know you're just going to get the latest on legal holds. If you don't want to RSS feed my blog, so and you can access that from my blog or John Jablonski at Twitter and find me very easily. Also, last plug, and I appreciate the time, there's a 10% discount at my blog for the book that's coming out really any day now, and definitely by the end of the month. So thanks.
Well, John, thanks. I'll tweet back to you with at ESI Bytes, which is our Twitter account now. And thanks again for the really detailed, informative podcast here on Legal Holds. You've been listening to Carl Schinneman from Jurnov and ESI Bytes. If you want to see a complete list of our podcasts on electronic discovery issues, you can go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of all the podcasts. Remember to visit ESI Bytes to learn more about electronic discovery before ESI bites you back. Thanks again, and have a nice day.